Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my
microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
This is Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Natasha Moore. I think I should start this episode with a bit of a confession, which is that when I was in high school, I decided at some point that science was just not for me. I wasn't interested in it. I had no aptitude for it. You were allowed to quit after year 10, and that was it. No more beakers or Punnett squares for me. But over the last few years, I've kind of cautiously been revising my relationship with science. Scientist friends have introduced me to not so much science itself, but what we might call a few gateway drugs to science, such as XKCD, which is indisputably the world's greatest webcomic. Someone lent me Richard Feynman's memoir. He's like the rock star of physics. It's called Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, and it's hilarious. I mean, it's not very much about physics, but it kind of eased me in, let's say. Last year, I leveled up and I read a book called Is There Purpose in Biology by Dennis Alexander. It was a bit more science than I'm used to, but I got most of it and I found it fascinating. So when I found out that Dennis Alexander was coming to Sydney to deliver the annual New College lectures, I knew that I had to try and get an interview.
My mother was one of the early women to read physiology in Oxford. Back in the late 1920s, we're going back a few years now, and there were only two women in her year, and they took a picture of her matriculation year. And I heard, when I was doing biochemistry at Oxford, I heard that these photos were up in our department because that's where the space was. So I went off and went back to whatever it was, 1928, and there I saw the picture of her year in physiology. And there was a sea of men, all in black gowns, obviously, and bow ties and all that sort of thing, and there were two women. One was my mother, and another was a great friend, and they were both Christians. So I sort of grew up with this idea. It never even crossed my mind that it wasn't a natural place to be, you know, to be a Christian in biology. It was just part of normal life, I guess.
So Dennis became a molecular biologist. He has done a lot of cancer research. He developed a national unit of human genetics in Lebanon. He was also director of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion in Cambridge, and he's been writing about science and religion for close to half a century now. His books have titles like Creation and Evolution, Do We Have to Choose? And Genes, Determinism, and God. It'll be clear from our conversation that I'm really not a scientist. My apologies to any biologists listening. Do bear with me. Dennis was very gracious in answering my semi-educated questions about evolution and randomness and creation and cancer. You don't often get to sit down with the person who wrote that book that you just read and really enjoyed. So I started off by asking him about the purpose of his book, Is There Purpose in Biology?
Well, the book I think is needed because of two reasons. One is that the new atheists sort of have a rhetoric that says that evolutionary biology is necessarily without purpose. And if you believe in evolution, then basically it's going to go any which way, and it's random, it's stochastic, it's non-predictable, and so forth and so on. I mean, that's often a sort of narrative that one finds. And because it doesn't have any purpose, well, obviously it can't be anything to do with God, because, you know, if God was involved, then it would have some sort of directionality in some kind. So there's another category of people who actually come from the other end of the spectrum, for the new atheists, those who call themselves creationists, and they also believe that if you believe in evolution, it has no purpose. And so they sort of agree with the new atheists on that point. There's an odd kind of an agreement, actually, between new atheism and creationists on that specific point, in the sense that when they look at biology, they say, well, if you believe in evolution, then it automatically means it doesn't go anywhere and it could be any which way. So I wanted to write a book which says I think that point of view is wrong.
And what's wrong with it?
Well, I think the point is that if you're thinking about things that are necessarily purposeless, I mean, we generally know, I think, what sorts of things are necessarily purposeless. Just by if you go down on the beach and you see a random collection of stones all over the place, They don't have any purpose. They're just stones and they're just being there. You know, they don't have any purpose to them. If in the old-fashioned television it went all fuzzy and you had something electronically really bad with your television, that fuzz was just random. It had no obvious purpose. So I think we sort of know instinctively almost, don't we, what sorts of things are necessarily without purpose. And so what I wanted to say as a biologist, and as, a, by the way, an evolutionary biologist, well, if we look at the history of evolution and if we look at the way that biology works, is that necessarily the case? Is it the sort of thing that when you look at it looks as if it's necessarily without purpose? Like I'm keeping words very carefully. Mm.
Well, because words are important here, aren't they? Because words like chance and random are used differently by biologists.
They are indeed.
To us ordinary people.
Well, we can come to that, yeah, definitely, and that's a very important point. But I think the main point is that if you just take a look at evolutionary biology, to me anyway, it doesn't look like something necessarily without purpose. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean to say you can read the purpose of life off from evolutionary biology. That's a whole different question. But at least I think from the science you can say, actually, when you look at it, it looks like it could easily be purposeful.
So what is it about evolution that looks like it might be purposeful? How is it not one big accident?
Well, I think if you stand back and look at the narrative of evolutionary biology and the origin of life, you know, 3.5 billion years ago or thereabouts, and if you track it through, you know, from first cells and then multicellular organisms and then the emergence of more and more complex neuronal systems, and you get to beings like us with our big brains with our 10 to the 11 neurons and thousands of connections, something like 60,000 miles of synaptic connections are wiring in our brains, and the most complex organism that we can think about in the universe, as far as we know so far. So, I mean, that sort of thing, you look at that narrative, you just stand back and look at the narrative as a whole, that to me doesn't look necessarily without purpose. I mean, you think, wow, okay, increased complexity, the emergence of minds that we can actually understand something about the world in which we live. We can write Schrodinger's equation as an equation that describes the properties of matter. We can write down little squiggles up on the blackboard and it somehow describes the kind of world that we live in. I mean, that to me looks very like some narrative going on there. So it's like a drama, you know, some sort of melodrama, theodrama, some people have called it, you know, theistic drama going on here, whereby it looks like it's going somewhere.
You're a molecular biologist.
Well, we all do molecular biology,
Because on a molecular level, am I right in saying that evolution doesn't look totally accidental or random at that level of things?
Well, that's right. So, I mean, interestingly, Richard Dawkins, in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, in the preface, says one of the reasons I'm writing this book is to demonstrate that evolution is not a theory of chance. A lot of people miss that, actually. As a matter of fact, most evolutionary biologists, I think, would deny, to a certain degree at least, the idea that evolution is a theory of chance. Now, why would we say that? Well, because you've got two bits of evolution. You've got the bits where you generate diversity through the mutations, the changes in the genetic letters of the DNA. Now, that is random in the sense that those changes don't happen with reference to the organism. They don't happen for the good or the ill of the organism. They just happen. Okay, so you get diversity within our DNA, and that diversity helps to explain all the diversity of all the humans in the world. Okay, if we didn't have that, we would all look like a clone, and life would be really boring. So in evolutionary terms then, natural selection then has a winnowing effect on selecting out the organisms that are best at passing their genes on to the next generation. Okay, we call that reproductive success in biology. In other words, there's a very tight constraint on what can get through. Okay, for example, if you're a mouse and you have a genetic mutation and the consequence is that you don't make some critical protein that will keep you alive, you're a dead mouse. Okay, you're not going to pass that on. I mean, that's basically how it works. Okay. So we're talking here about reproductive success, about, as it were, all those genetic variants being tested out in the workshop of life in order that if a lion can run a little bit faster, it will catch its prey and it will pass on that particular set of genetic variants to the next generation. So in other words, that's why it's not chance, because the whole process is predicated on The ability to adapt to a particular environment, particular ecological niche, as we say in biology. Okay.
So there are kind of these guardrails that mean, because there are certain conditions and certain building blocks of life, things end up going in particular directions that are not
random. That is true. And that's also part of the story and part of the reason why things keep evolving in the same way. It's called convergent evolution. So actually in Cambridge, we have someone called Simon Conway-Morris, who's professor of paleobiology there. And as Simon points out, you know, convergence is all over the place in evolutionary history. So what that means is that in independent evolutionary lineages, that is to say they're not inheriting something from your predecessors, but independently you've got the same sorts of things that keep evolving again and again and again. They're converging
like
on the same solution. Eyes is a classic example, compound eyes and so forth. Camera eyes have evolved more than 20 times easily in the history of evolution independently. So a lot of people who have a problem with evolution often think the eye is a real problem, and it was for Darwin. It happens to be now one of the exemplars of how evolution keeps happening, and you keep converging on the eye. I mean, because if you live in a planet of light and darkness and so on, you need eyes. So eyes, you'll get them. Just wait long enough and they'll come along. Okay. So, and if you go and live in a cave, you'll lose your eyes and they decayed away. So you see they disappear gradually with time, and you can see examples of that as well. So
this idea that if we reran the tape, mm-hmm. if we could go back to the start and you know, see how things went the second time around, if evolution were kind of a total accident and we're a total accident, you would expect that it wouldn't go the same way again. But that's not quite
the case, I think. Yeah. So the example you're giving there was a favorite of Stephen Jay Gould, you know, the late famous evolutionary biologist from Harvard. And he did think if you play the tape of life again, it's just going to end up totally different. And actually, Simon Conway-Morris says, actually, no. Probably if you're just looking at the data, if you're looking at the evidence that we have, it looks like if you replay the tape of life again, it's going to look pretty similar. Now, not exactly the same. Nobody's claiming that, I think. But I think Simon would say something like us would evolve eventually, something, you know, which is intelligent and which has consciousness eventually. Might not have five fingers and five toes, but, you know, it might have six or whatever. You know, we're not talking so much about the detail, but about the general principle, the same sorts of things are going to evolve.
Side point here, does that mean that you imagine that life elsewhere in the universe is likely
to be the same?
Or likely to exist.
To exist, firstly. well, as a biochemist, okay, so if you point your telescope anywhere in the universe, and it's a very powerful one, you can detect carbon everywhere you look. There's carbon all the way around the universe. Okay. So what we get in the moments of dying stars are the elements, the heavier elements, not real heavy ones, but heavier enough to be able to form life. Okay. Carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, those sort of things. So they are created in the moments of dying stars, supernovae, where there's sufficient energy to drive that chemical synthesis. Those are all over the universe, okay, and especially carbon. So it's very likely that I think we'll find life eventually, maybe not in my lifetime, but I would love that to be the case, okay, very exciting. But I would be very surprised if there's not some form of life in other parts of even our own immediate, the stars we can see. There are 10 to 22 stars. It turns out that many of them have planets circulating around them. Now we know that from the Hubble telescope and other telescopes. And some of those planets, it turns out, are in the so-called Goldilocks zone, in the zone where life is possible, where you're going to get some water. It's not too hot, not too cold, that sort of thing. So I think it's very likely we'll find life in other planets. But then, of course, the question is, will it be similar life? And probably, I suspect, it probably will be rather similar and might be a little bit boring for science fiction enthusiasts. We're all hoping for something really radical. And you might get there and think, oh, we've seen this before. Mm. And the reason you might think that is because carbon almost certainly is the best element that we have for forming life. You might do it through silicon, but carbon has better properties, really, for life. I think everyone agrees on that one. And we know that there's carbon everywhere in the universe and so forth, and we know the laws of chemistry and physics are the same everywhere and so forth, as far as we know. And so if you get the same kind of conditions, you have a bit of water, you know, you're going to get life. I mean, that's how I would view it. Even, I mean, some people would even say that the genetic code will be likely to look very similar.
Wow.
Which is an interesting thought. But yeah. That, we're getting up the speculative end here.
Yeah, sure.
But I personally, as a biochemist, wouldn't be surprised.
So to come back to evolution on this planet, the way that we often talk about evolution, even though a lot of people would think of it as kind of accidental and random, we'd often speak about it in ways that imply purpose. You know, we kind of say evolution does this or it does that in order to bring about this outcome. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's suggestive that humans do kind of automatically look for purpose in things and see purpose in things? You know, I think of the writer C.S. Lewis talks about how, you know, the fact that we have hunger implies that there is such a thing as food, and that we have thirst, that there's such a thing as, and, you know, that we have longing for affection, there's such a thing as relationship. Do you think that our tendency as humans to talk about purpose and to see purpose in things suggests that there is?
Well, I think it can be a pointer. And you're right. Even if you do a little stick man or even a little spot on the screen moving around, people often interpret that as a sort of human or chase going on or something like that, even though that little spot on the screen has no human characteristics. So I think we have this very powerful tendency to interpret things that move in biological terms or even in human terms. So we anthropomorphize things very quickly. And I think actually that's part of our humanity. I don't think it's a bad thing. I'm criticizing, I'm just sort of observing. It's part of our humanity and a recognition that things that look like us, we better be careful. They might be, you know, they might be us and so forth. So I do think there's... that purpose is built into the way we think about things quite a bit. But, of course, that doesn't tell us what the purpose is. Okay, that's the key thing, isn't it? So, yeah.
Because we also, we look for purpose in our own lives as humans. Even if we do look at evolutionary biology and think that it's a purposeless process, we tend not to accept that.
Well, that's right. And I think... in my book, Is There Purpose in Biology? I sort of start by saying, well, does evolutionary biology look necessarily purposeless? No. So what happens in practice? Everybody imposes their own purpose upon the narrative. And if you're Richard Dawkins, you write books and you're successful and you become famous and you make money from giving lectures and sure a lot more money than I do from making lectures and so on. So, but, you know, you create a world around yourself which has immediate purpose of some kind. And by the way, as a Christian, it so happens, in my view anyway, evolutionary biology fits extremely well, you know, within a Christian theistic framework. And why is that? Well, one of the reasons is that Charles Darwin was raised in a Christian atmosphere. He read divinity, of course, at Cambridge. And he drifted away from his faith in later life. But The Origin of Species has been called by some historians, the last great work of Victorian natural theology.
Well, and this would be surprising to a lot of people, because you say in your book, actually, that for a lot of Christians in the 19th century, they took evolution as reinforcing Christian belief, that they thought it was an argument for the Christian worldview.
Yes.
How
yes.
does that work?
So what happened was, right at the beginning of the 19th century, Archdeacon William Paley and his writings on natural theology became very popular. In fact, they were a required reading for generations of Cambridge undergraduates. The only problem about that is what you end up with in a sort of Paleyan natural theology is a very rationalistic, kind of somewhat cold view of God. I mean, God is then the great designer who fits everything together and puts everything in place, and it's all rather mechanical, actually, in some ways. And you get the idea of God much more as this distant, rather deistic sort of God, a God who's not very involved. So there were people like Aubrey Moore, for example, who was the head of the Botanical Gardens in Oxford University, and he just felt that Darwin's theory was a gift. And the reason he thought that is because here we have a God who is involved in the evolutionary process all the way through, much more like an author of creation, someone who's intimately involved in the whole process all the way through. And he felt that it helped to restore what we call in Christian theology the immanence of God in creation. That is to say, God is involved in the created order and who can be involved in people's lives as well.
So is that what you're meaning when you say that the picture of evolution we have is particularly compatible with the Christian worldview?
I think so. Partly that, yes. I mean, it's partly compatible because certainly the biblical understanding of God is a God who's involved in the created order all the time. Through you go to the great passages of the Old Testament which talk about God as creator in the Isaiah, Job, Psalm 104, all over the place. And it's always a God who's involved in the created order. I don't mean that God is part of the process itself, but simply God's authorship is very intimate, really, in the created order. I mean, after all, if you're reading a book, you wouldn't go to chapter 3, the second paragraph, and say, "Aha! Finally, I think the author was involved in that paragraph." Okay, so either the author is there for the whole book or not. I think in this view, so that's where I would start in talking about God as creator.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Dennis Alexander is a biologist and a Christian, and he's convinced that the evolutionary history of our planet and of our species maps onto the trajectory described in the Bible. So I wanted to know how those two pictures fit together: creation, heaven, the huge amount of suffering that we see in the natural world. He's done some really careful thinking around all of this. We started in the beginning with Adam and Eve.
It seems to me that the text of both the Old and the New Testament takes Adam very seriously, the language of Adam and Eve and so forth. So I personally do see a beginning in terms of humanity, people who really know God, which I don't think personally we have to fit into some evolutionary scheme. I don't think that's necessary. In fact, there was a rector of a church in London called Sols Langham Place, John Stott, who came up with a language of homo divinus, this sort of idea, whereby the sort of narrative we're reading about in the Old and the New Testament, talking about an Adam and Eve and so forth, is talking about the beginning of God's new humanity, those who really come to know God as a one true God. And in a sense, what we're reading about in the early chapters of Genesis is making this huge contrast between one God who does everything as compared to the rival polytheistic creation stories of the nations around Israel at that time and so forth. So in other words, the homo divinus then would be those who first come to know God in a personal way, and they already have the capacities, they have language, they have consciousness, they have a moral sense and so forth. What they don't have that is that spiritual life, that knowledge of God. And I guess Christians would say it's the same today. In other words, you walk around the streets of Sydney and you could look at some people, everyone looks the same, more or less, and some people have spiritual life and some people don't. Okay. In other words, it's much more to do with a relational question about relationship with God. Okay. So the question then comes, well, who were the first human individuals who had a real personal relationship with God, whereby they had a sense of their own responsibility to care for the earth and to look after each other and to have a relationship with male and female, all that sort of thing. Okay, so that's the way I would go with that, I think, if you wanted to have a discussion, if you like, between anthropology and between biology. So I certainly believe all the biological data we have about the evolution of humans and so forth, which is a moving target, it's changing all the time, but I mean, it's still pretty clear that anatomically modern humans emerged sometime over the past 200 to 300,000 years. I mean, that looks probably in Africa, and then went out of Africa and populated the world. And then the model I'm suggesting, or the understanding I'm suggesting, is that at some point God chooses maybe some Neolithic farmers in the Near East. You know, he chooses these people to reveal himself to, and to then, if you like, become the Adam and Eve of the Genesis text in that way. That's a model. I mean, you don't find that in the Bible, clearly, but it's a way of having a conversation between biology and theology on that point.
And then the new creation, that's kind of this idea of a future world.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Well,
think about that as a biologist.
As a biologist, I just think that if you're just a biologist and you're just looking at this world, then death is the end of it, okay, the end of the story. So you better look for something else if you want to see the hope for the future, really, in this respect. So, but within the Christian framework, as Christ dies on the cross and is risen from the dead so that we can share in his resurrection life through faith in him, that also provides a guarantee by God that we will share a similar kind of resurrection body in the future in a new heavens and a new earth. So biology then is going to carry on, okay, so in the Christian vision. And exactly how that works, we don't know. But certainly I think all Christians would see in his new heavens and a new earth that the Bible talks about, that we would see animals in there, we would see, whether we'd see every animal and every mosquito that ever lived, I don't know about that, but we'd certainly see a representation of, you know, all the wonderful diversity, biological diversity that we see now, except that it would be transformed and amplified. And all those who put their trust in Christ and who are raised by God into this resurrection new life would then share in this diversity of this new heavens and new earth. That's the vision. And that's really important for environmentalists, by the way, because it means that when we're worried about, which we should be worried about, the extinction of certain species, this isn't just because, you know, for utilitarian reasons that somehow we're going to lose out on that as humans. No, it's because these are all part of God's precious created order, and we want to see that diversity expressed also in the new creation as well. And so we better start now in doing what we're going to do for eternity, you know, to preserve and care for the created order. So it's linked actually with environmental concerns very much.
So what does this do for what we might call natural evils? Things like, I mean, death for starters, but also parasites, cancer, natural disasters, all that kind of thing. How does that fit in your theological and biological framework?
Obviously, this is the $1,000 question, clearly, that if you take that stance, the stance I'm taking here, how can a God of love create a world in which there is so much apparent natural evil? You know, again, this is a huge topic, as you know, and books have been written. And I would, what I'm going to say now, I'm not suggesting is the best way that someone suffering might want to cope with this right now, but I'm just going to speak as a biologist and as a Christian. From that sort of perspective, clearly life and death go together. You can't have life without death. I'm talking about biology now. You know, just if we didn't have death, this planet would be extremely overcrowded. Everything is dying to make room for the living. As far as biology is concerned, we're all part of these lengthy food chains. We all feed off each other. We're all feeding on stuff. We do that every time, unless we're vegetarian. Or something, you know, we're feeding off other animals and so forth. So the whole of life is this complex network of relationship in which we are dependent upon each other. I'm talking about each other now in a sort of general biological sense of any living organism. And we will all die. Okay, so that's part of the system. Once you have carbon-based life, you're going to have carbon-based death. Okay, and once you have that, then that's physical death. So without some hope of a future life with Christ or, you know, in a resurrection body, then you'd have to say physical death is the end of the line. And if you're an atheist, of course, that's what you say. Okay. As a Christian, I say, no, I really think the evidence for the resurrection of Christ is very profound. And therefore, that will lead on to, as I mentioned, our own resurrection. Now, of course, you then want to say, well, yeah, but couldn't God just create everything nice? I mean, why? I mean, why do we have to live with all this bad stuff? Yeah, he could do anything he wants, okay? And so there must be particular reasons why God has brought us, if you like, through this long process of evolution and where we are now and having the ability to respond to his love or not. And I want to say, well, it looks to me like what we have is a sort of package deal, you know, so that all the good stuff and all the, if you like, bad stuff, stuff we don't like, just go together, okay? So if you have carbon-based life, you're going to get carbon-based death. That's the way it's going to go. If you are going to live as we are in this particular world, you need pain receptors. If you don't have pain receptors, you're going to die quite soon because you won't know that you're walking around with a broken leg or, you know, munching on glass or something. So evils, are, in terms of natural evils, I don't personally call them natural evils because I think it's a little bit confusing, really. If we simply mean stuff we prefer to do without, okay, that's fine. And none of us want cancer. None of us want to have pain. fine. Okay, if you want to call that evil, that's fine. But it seems to be a little confusing because to me, evil really refers to what happens if we make a moral decision and we do the evil thing, you know, we do the wrong thing. And it seems to me evil is much clearer in that context. Let's put it away. Okay.
So what does that mean that God has to say about cancer?
So what that means is that if you have an evolutionary process where you've got genetic diversity, again, it's a package deal. And so the fact of our existence as unique individuals everywhere in the world is definitely due to our genetic diversity. Okay. So if you want to have a diverse population of billions and millions of people, as which we do have, that we know for sure every single human individual that ever lived or ever will live will be unique. Even if they're twins, they are epigenetically different. Even if their DNA sequence is exactly the same, they will still be different in other ways, okay? Because of the way that genes are switched on and off and all that sort of thing. So that diversity is generated through genetic diversity, but that same genetic diversity will give a risk of cancer, okay? It's a package deal that goes along with it, okay? It's part of the process. Now, the good news, of course, is that in the Christian worldview, this is a temporary phase, okay? This is looking forward to the life which is to come, when there will be no cancer, there will be no suffering. Okay, Jesus was perfectly clear about that. Okay, so then you say, well, why? Okay, why that and then that? Okay, why don't we just jump to heaven straight away? I mean, you know, the only rationale, the rationale I see personally is that what we have is the price of existence of human beings who are able to have free will and to respond freely to God's love or not, who have moral responsibility, that is a big price to pay. And the price we pay is our evolutionary history and our failing biological human bodies. Okay, with that understanding, to me, anyway, as a biologist, it makes a lot more sense. Okay, if that's where you have to go in order to have where we are now, which gives that capability to respond to God. In other words, if God's desire is to have people in his future kingdom who are there by free will and not by force, and it seems to me the only way you can have love is by free will. You cannot force love. And if you want free will, then you need human beings with this particular characteristics. And therefore, that's the sort of package deal that makes sense to me. Now, I don't for a moment think that's the ultimate answer to the problem of suffering. Okay, but I think it might be part of it.
This is sort of in some ways, a kind of clinical answer, you as a scientist saying this. But this is also personal for you. You mm-hmm. have experience of this yourself, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I mean, a few years ago, as many people do, I had bowel cancer. I had an operation, had 12 rounds of chemotherapy. That was about four years ago, was it? And it hasn't come back yet, for which I'm thankful. And so I know a little bit about that. Well, of course, I've done cancer research as well.
Yeah.
And when you have cancer and you've also done cancer research, it has a particular frisson. It has a particular feel about it because you sort of know which ways it might go.
Did the experience of going through this change at all the answer you've given me about cancer not being a natural evil? And, you know, does that still make sense to you through the personal experience?
It does, actually, yes. Now, of course, as a Christian, I believe God has a plan for all our lives. God works out his plan. So I do believe very much in God as Father, but a God that I can trust for my future. And, of course, I did my research on my surgeon. I'm a practical man as well.
Yeah.
And was encouraged when he said, I'm one of the top two surgeons in the British Isles to do this kind of operation. That kind of gives you encouragement. But you also know, you know, that accidents happen and, you know, you can never be sure and things happen in surgery, blah, blah, especially when you're getting on a little bit. And I actually thought, wouldn't it be a fantastic way to go to heaven under anesthetic, I have to confess. I didn't want to particularly, you know, but I mean, I just thought, what a great way to go. You know, you just go straight off and to be with God. I mean, so I was sort of, that was a thought I certainly had. But I also knew that I had a number of people praying for me who didn't want that to happen. And not that I wanted it to happen, but. And so I think as a Christian, you can be pretty sure God's going to work it out one way or the other. Okay. But I have to say also that what we've been talking about, which is much more, if you like, the intellectual, theoretical side of things, I find actually pastorally important for me. maybe it's because I'm a biologist, but the idea of actually I'm part of this great system with this particular genome, with this particular DNA, which makes errors, and so I get cancer. Okay, so it's all part of this package deal whereby we can exist, whereby we can even have the ability to respond to God and come to know him and so forth. So to me, that's a big deal, actually. That's a really big deal.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Natasha Moore, and that was Dennis Alexander, a molecular biologist at Cambridge, and the author of, most recently, Is There Purpose in Biology? The Cost of Existence and the God of Love. Dennis was in Sydney to deliver the 2018 New College Lectures on the topic of genetics, God, and the future of humanity. You can listen to those lectures online. We've put that link in the episode description. As always, you can find this and many, many other conversations, as well as loads of other content, on our website, publicchristianity.org. Don't forget to subscribe to Life and Faith, leave us a rating or review, or tell a friend if you liked this episode and you think they would as well. Next week.
Gertrude Stein once said, a rose is a rose is a rose. And people think freedom is freedom is freedom. No. Freedom is tricky. You've got to know what you mean and how you can achieve it.